from deep inside your radio.
Yes, indeed, back at the Le Chaux Dôme, just to get my feet warm. You know, there are those of us who can spend quality time in a freezing climate and find it very difficult then to get the feet unfrozen in the aftermath. But now they're warm again, back here where, hey, the Golden Globes are on tonight. And Ricky, don't lose the number of the lawyer who's suing them. Because, there's a lawyer suing the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, claiming that the whole thing is corrupt and paid off. And, wow, the Globes? Next thing you're going to be telling me is Miss America is somehow weird. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your brain on the war on drugs. The day after a Rockland, New York family was terrorized by heavily armed police who burst into their home looking for someone who didn't live there, the federal agency that organized the drug raid has apologized. This should be the apologies of the week, but it's not. John P. Gilbride, special agent in charge, issued a statement clearing Spring Valley resident David McKay and his family of anything to do with the series of drug raids that took place in suburban New York early Thursday morning. We sincerely regret that while attempting to execute an arrest warrant for a member of this drug trafficking organization, the innocent McKay family is inadvertently affected by the enforcement operation, he said. The raid was directed at a group, a consortium that transported marijuana from the West Coast to the East Coast. Ooh, I hate that. At 5:30 Thursday morning, to prevent that marijuana from being shipped from the West Coast to East Coast, the family said at least 8 police officers, drawn weapons, barged into the house, pointed guns at the family, and threatened to shoot their dogs, ladies and gentlemen. The officers were screaming for someone named Michael when David McKay, the householder, tried to explain that no one named Michael lived at the house. McKay said police pulled him outside the home in his underwear in the freezing cold. That'll teach him. That'll teach him to transport. Oh, he wasn't. Officers pulled his 8th-grade daughter out of her bed at gunpoint and dragged her down the stairs. The girl later vomited, fainted, and had an asthma attack. She will not do drugs. That's the anti-drug. Vomiting? Asthma attacks? Sure. This is your brain on the war. It's now, what, 40 years? And we're ladies and gentlemen, news of, and I've been asked by a listener to back off when I do this sound because it's too loud for him. There you go. News of AFPAC. A top, and here, just in time, after we've spent $1 trillion on Iraq, a top U.S. military official calls Pakistan the epicenter of global terrorism. See what we did? We didn't do anything. He emphasizes that America's success in Afghanistan is a distant dream. Yeah, I am feeling sleepy. Unless and until terror havens in Pakistan are dismantled. Well, let's see. What are you doing Tuesday? A statement from Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, vindicates India's stand about Pakistan, according to an Indian newspaper, The Times of India. He says, I've said it before and I'll say it again. Pakistan is the epicenter of terrorism in the world right now. It deserves the attention of everybody to do as much as we can to eliminate that threat. When did he say it before? When we were thinking of invading Iraq? Maybe not. He says it's not just Haqqani anymore, one of the major organizations, or Al-Qaeda, or the Afghan Taliban, or Lashkar-e-Taiba. It's all of them working together in ways that 2 years ago they absolutely did not. Gee, what's happened in the last 2 years? Oh, the surge. Stressing the importance of dismantling terror camps in Afghanistan, he says it's absolutely critical that the safe havens in Pakistan get shut down. We cannot succeed without that. All right, then. At least we're warned by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Ladies and gentlemen, what are our music stars doing these days? You know, in the boomer days, our rock stars were living the high life. Maybe they got into charities. Here's what 50 Cent is doing. 50 Cent, a.k.a. Curtis J. Jackson III, was busily sending out Twitter messages to his 3.5 million followers last week. Instead of talking about new music, the popular rapper was supposedly, quote, looking out for ya, by touting a little-known penny stock called H&H Imports that sent H&H's stock price soaring 270% in a matter of hours. The problem? 50 Cent is a majority owner of H&H. He acquired specifically because H&H would soon be promoting products developed by, quote, affiliates of Mr. Jackson, unquote. This would not be pertaining to concerts. Hello, welcome to the show. From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm the guy with the golden voice from the home of the homeless. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And ladies and gentlemen, we in this country, our media were monopolized this week by the post shooting yakking all over the place. Sarah Palin, etc. So you may have missed a lot of stuff that's been going on in the world. A lot of stuff actually happened this week. But two British newspapers reported this weekend a timeline for Jared Lochner's activities the night before the shooting. Apparently, very restless young man that night. One of the things they reported that he did was pose for a photograph with his gun, dressed only in a red G-string, reported both by the Telegraph and the Independent in London. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I think this has gone about far enough. You know, the coarseness of our political culture that has allowed red G-strings to be sold willy-nilly, I think has led inexorably to this. We know the effect that the color red has on bulls, for example. We know that the effect that G-strings have on men. The combination is explosive. Can we all just agree? I couldn't believe that this was left out of the president's. Can we all just agree to live a life without red G-strings, ladies and gentlemen? Can we? Please? Now? Thank you. News of the Corps of Engineers now, ladies and gentlemen. Because they're so good at what they... River forecasters for the National Weather Service underestimated the flood level that a major river would reach during... Remember Nashville's fatal floods last May? Yep. Well, forecasters underestimated the flood level that the river would reach because they relied on inaccurate data from... Right over here, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, ladies and gentlemen. That's according to the National Weather Service's report released this week. It found that forecasters ignored two models, computer models, that showed more accurate flood predictions for the Cumberland River in favor of a model that relied on inaccurate and untimely information from the Corps. The Weather Service continued to use that data despite observations on the ground that proved their flood predictions were inaccurate. You going to believe the Corps or your lying eyes? That meant the Weather Service failed to warn of major flooding in Nashville until after it had already taken place. Well, you know, still. The report also found that many residents did not respond to flood warnings because those warnings did not reflect the urgency of the situation. The flooding killed 22 people and caused more than $2 billion in damages in Nashville alone. So, heads up to the Corps. Nice work, again. After a conference call with the Corps at 8:30 on the morning, the Weather Service issued a public prediction of flood levels reaching only 41 feet, just below the moderate flood level. That prediction relied on the Corps' estimates of how much water it was releasing from dams. The agency was constantly adjusting the flow, but not updating the Weather Service about those changes. Thank you. The Weather Service report also says some of the flow data reported by the Corps were not accurate even at the moment they were received. Your Corps of Engineers, ladies and gentlemen, building strong, destroying stronger. And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
In this heated political climate, using the word Gestapo to describe a proposal you don't like is probably not the best idea. Minnesota State Representative Sandra Erickson, a Republican, now realizes it. She was quoted Tuesday on Minnesota Public Radio discussing a proposal for alternative teacher training that had been supported by the state teachers' union, a plan for alternative licensing. Erickson, a retired teacher, said the requirement that they be kept under close supervision for 90 days sounded like, quote, the teacher Gestapo. After an outcry from the AFL-CIO, Erickson apologized. My apologies to everyone out there. I certainly didn't intend to cast aspersions on my profession. I love my profession. I think the world of teachers. I guess I just have a little problem with the union's demands, and we'll work that out. Seek hot. Oh, she didn't say that. Dateline Middleton, Ohio, Councilman A.J. Smith apologized Thursday for his actions at a Middletown restaurant last week that resulted in a call to police. Officers were called to the Applebee's after a waitress accused Smith, 21, councilman, 21, fast riser, of not paying for a $2.50 bottle of Heineken. Smith left the restaurant after a dispute with a female acquaintance. It was later determined that the city economic director paid for the beer. No charges were filed. Police did take a report of the incident. Smith said he never meant for his actions to negatively impact the city. I would like to apologize to the community for any negativity that this has brought out and any negative reflection on the city and myself, he said. It is something we will get past, and I will continue to work for the city of Middletown. Not doing good in the neighborhood. The head of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's press office apologized this week for the intensive security screening several journalists were subjected to before a cocktail party they were invited to by the government. Several members of the Foreign Press Corps who showed up for the party this week with personal invitations and press cards they can only acquire after extensive background checks still were told to remove their clothes during screenings by Israel's Shin Bet security service. The incident was called Bragate by the Jerusalem Post because one Arab Israeli journalist working for Al Jazeera was denied entry to the event because she agreed to take off some of her clothing but refused to take off her brassiere. Dateline Tallahassee, Florida. Hello, Tallahassee. There were apologies all around this week as members of the Senate Budget Committee heard from those involved in building the new posh courthouse for the First District Court of Appeals. Two of the court's judges apologized if they went beyond what legislators wanted when they built the $50 million courthouse. Legislators apologized for giving the court so much money in the first place. The Department of Management Services apologized for not supervising the project properly. Dateline Lincoln, Nebraska. Contracted Louisiana-based company took the blame for phone calls made overnight to some Lincoln residents informing them about the city's snow emergency this week. The system was activated around 2:30 in the afternoon last Sunday, a little before the mayor declared the snow emergency at 4 p.m. The calls were made to tell residents about parking bans. Some were made between midnight and 5 a.m. The company, First Call in Baton Rouge, President Matt Teague, apologized for the calls. He said his staff is trained to stop such calls at 10 p.m., but that didn't happen this time. Did he blame the clocks? He did not. Gainesville, Florida, sports columnist Pat Dooley has apologized for a questionable remark he made on Twitter about Virginia Tech coach Frank Beamer last week. Shouldn't have made it. I apologize to Coach Beamer and his family. Sometimes we think Twitter is our own little world of friends in the press box. Good lesson. At Arrowhead Stadium, the middle of the field during the Kansas City-Baltimore game was a lighter shade than the rest of the field. Dooley wrote in his tweet, "Why does Kansas City Field look like Frank Beamer's face?" The veteran Virginia Tech coach's face was damaged from an explosion and nearly 30 subsequent surgeries from when he was a child. Dooley's Twitter comment has since been removed. Within hours of the Tucson tragedy, Arizona Daily Star editorial cartoonist and columnist David Fitzsimmons apologized for his politically charged remarks. Fitzsimmons was on the scene Saturday at the Tucson Shopping Center after, you know what happened. He reportedly told CNN in the aftermath, which I guess is where they were basing their coverage, that big aftermath parked outside. "I'm pretty shaken, frankly. This is a very surreal, dreamlike experience. As a columnist who's covered politics in the state, it was inevitable from my perspective." He said he viewed the shooting as inevitable in a state with an intense gun culture and politics that are to the rabid right. "The right in Arizona, and I'm speaking very broadly," he continued, "has been stoking the fires of a heated anger and rage successfully in this state," he told CNN. In his apology, Fitzsimmons, who considers Representative Giffords a friend, said, quote, "Today I've offended many with my emotional, partisan, and inappropriate remarks broadcast on CNN regarding the horror of this day. Reflecting on the moment, I know my remarks would have disappointed Congresswoman Giffords." In issuing the apology, the newspaper he writes for says he wasn't reporting and didn't know at the time who the shooter was or his motivation. The owner of a downtown Montreal children's clothing boutique caught in a breastfeeding controversy issued a formal apology this week to the nursing mother forced to leave the store last week. The apology came in a letter addressed to Shannon Smith. A mother of three was told that she was not allowed to breastfeed an orchestra at a children's clothing store in the former Eaton's. Yeah, Eaton's closed. "You can't do that," was what the 36-year-old nursing mother was told by a clerk as she nursed her five-month-old daughter in an in-store play area with another nursing mom. "We recognize the shortcoming in our training," says Jean-Claude Oliana, president of Les Vêtements Orchestra Canada Incorporated, a Canadian subsidiary of the French-based children's clothing store. We assure you that our business policy on the question of breastfeeding is unquestionably the effect that clients can, if they must, breastfeed inside the boutique. Yana wrote in a one-page letter sent to the mother and issued to the media. The woman who had asked her to stop nursing her daughter, he says, was a newly hired part-timer. The employees received appropriate disciplinary measures on that there. Also in Canada, the 82-year-old woman crying foul over treatment at the hands of Calgary Airport security staff has received the apology she was asking for, left on her voicemail. Nice touch. Elizabeth Strecker, who says she was humiliated during a recent security check at Calgary International Airport, said two messages were left by officials. I phoned back, but I couldn't reach them anymore, so I guess they don't work on weekends, she said, but they tried. She lost a breast to cancer 5 years ago, claimed she was forced to bear her gel prosthesis to security staff on January 4th. The screeners she encountered grew wary of her initial response to questions regarding gels or liquids. She told staff she was not in possession of either when a full body scan revealed her prosthesis. The family of Arizona gunman Jared Lochner apologized this week to relatives of those he's accused of gunning down, saying in a first statement since the shooting, "We are so very sorry for their loss. This is a very difficult time for us. We ask the media to respect our privacy." And finally, on that subject, this from NPR News. An editor's note. Quote, "On behalf of NPR News, I apologize for this mistake to the family of Representative Giffords, to the families of everyone affected by the shootings, to our listeners, and to our readers. The information we reported," parenthetically, in case you didn't know, NPR reported for at least an hour that Representative Giffords had been killed. "The information we reported came from two different governmental sources, including a source in the sheriff's office. Nonetheless, in a situation so chaotic and changing so swiftly, we should have been more cautious. There were obviously conflicting reports from authorities and other sources. The error we made was unintentional, an error of judgment in a fast-breaking situation. It was corrected immediately, but we deeply regret the error. Please give." The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. What does the new Miss America think about WikiLeaks? Thank goodness you asked, because last night on the telecast, she answered.
You know, when it came to that situation, it was actually based on espionage, and that when it comes to the security of our nation, we have to focus on security first, and then people's right to know, because it's so important that everybody within our borders is safe, and so we can't let things like that happen, and they must be handled properly, and I think that was the case.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you. On the other hand, in the wake of the revolution, the apparent revolution in Tunisia, did you hear about that? Yeah, it happened this week. The Norwegian newspaper Aftenpost, which has somehow received custody of all of the documents in the WikiLeaks State Department cable file, has released a series of U.S. diplomatic cables from 2006 on massive and pervasive corruption and nepotism in Tunisia and its effects on economic and social problems. The cables show the U.S. government was fully aware of the dangerous and debilitating level of corruption in Tunisia and its anti-democratic implications. They raise the question of whether Washington was wise to make Zine al-Abidine Ben Ali the pillar of its North Africa policy because of his role in repressing Muslim movements. Why did they hate us? Oh, I don't know. The U.S. Embassy in Tunis noted the contradictions of what was once called the Tunisian miracle, relative stability and security and 5% growth a year, but with mafia-style corruption on the part of ruling cliques that was discouraging foreign investment and contributing to failing banks and high unemployment. Oh, man, I wish we had failing banks. Most debilitating and destabilizing, high levels of unemployment, especially for college graduates. The cables recognized the pervasiveness of government corruption and the scandals around that it gave rise to. 50% of the country's economic elite was somehow related to President Ben Ali, according to the U.S. cables. And they warned that they were increasingly showing off their opulence in public, raising the hackles of the poor and unemployed. In this country, we keep our hackles down when we see people showing off their opulence, don't we? You need hackle training. That's all. The cables are eloquent about the corruption of the Ben Ali and Tribulsi clans, the relatives and in-laws of the president, and the way he began dragging down the economy. But, you know, if it's not good enough for Miss America, it's not good enough for me. So, what the hell? It was based on espionage. She knows that. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the latest on the new F-bomb, foreclosure. Just a little insight into what's really happening down on the ground. A Cuyahoga County, that's Cleveland, juvenile court judge faces foreclosure on his 8-bedroom lakefront Cleveland home. He fell a year behind on nearly $1 million in mortgage and property taxes. He makes $121,000 a year as a judge. Said he has the money to make his mortgage payments. What got him in trouble was following the advice of officials at J.P. Morgan Chase, he said. With property values in decline and mortgage rates the lowest in decades, Sikora sought to refinance. The bank, he said, declined his request. The bank advised me the only way they would consider a loan modification would be if I fell behind on my payments, he said. I took their advice and put the money aside. He said he was surprised when in June, during the middle of negotiations, J.P. Morgan Chase filed the foreclosure lawsuit against him, seeking $999,000. Attorneys for J.P. Morgan Chase had no comment. The new F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen, coming your way soon.
What is the wrong conclusion? Why do we hesitate? What is going on now? Stop and re-estimate. What is the wrong conclusion? Why do we hesitate? What is going on now? Stop and re-estimate. What is the wrong conclusion?
Whatever came of the flame we had to follow.
What is going on now?
Did it disappear
and re-estimate? Moral is the wrong conclusion. Why do we hesitate?
Hey.
What is going on?
This is Le Show from the warm foot capital of the world, warm feet capital of the world. So what's the upshot on the whole big deep BP oil spill deal? The Oil Spill Commission has released their final report. Did you hear about that? Yeah. This is from Chapter 5. During the spill, the governors and other state political officials participated in the response in unprecedented ways, taking decisions out of the hands of career oil spill responders. These high-level state officials, hey, Bobby, were much less familiar with spill response planning. When confronted with a contingency plan setting out how the federal and state governments were supposed to run an oil spill response, one high-level state official told a Coast Guard responder that he'd never signed it. He wasn't questioning whether the signature appeared on the document, but asserting he had not substantively reviewed the plan. State and local officials largely rejected the pre-spill plans, began to create their own response. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal's advisors reportedly spent days trying to determine whether the Stafford Act or the National Contingency Plan applied. Louisiana declined to empower the officials it sent to work with federal responders inside the Unified Command, instead requiring most decisions to go through the governor's office. Coast Guard responders watched Governor Jindal and the TV cameras following him return to what appeared to be the same spot of oiled marsh day after day to complain about the inadequacy of the federal response, even though only a small amount of marsh was then oiled. When the Coast Guard sought to clean up that location, Governor Jindal refused to confirm the location. Journalists encouraged state and local officials and residents to display their anger at the federal response and offered coverage when they did. Anderson Cooper reportedly asked a parish president to bring an angry, unemployed offshore oil worker on his show. When the parish president could not promise the worker would be angry, both were disinvited.
Keeping him honest.
Anderson Cooper, who called it Obama's Katrina. Obama's Katrina is yet to come. Stand by when this new levee system is complete. Mm-mm. By the way, the Army Corps of Engineers was told by Congress in 2007 to empanel a peer review group to study and review all of its planning and construction for the new system in New Orleans. That group has been empaneled. Last year, held its first meeting in November after all the design and most of the construction were completed. Building strong. Back to the oil spill report. There's a 43-page chapter that suggests that berms and boom were pretty much a failure, collecting more headlines than oil. You heard on this program about the shortcomings of boom. Berms were the favored solution of Governor Bobby Jindal and Plaquemine Parish President Billy Nungesser. Garrett Graves, Governor Jindal's top advisor on coastal issues, said the commission's report showed contempt for the Cajun ingenuity that was the real saving grace in the disaster. The commission did call on Congress to create an independent safety agency to oversee oil drilling, raise the $75 million oil spill liability ceiling, and dedicate 80% of any Clean Water Act penalties paid by BP to restoring the Gulf Coast. But who gained the most from the whole deal? Maybe BP. This happened this week, ladies and gentlemen. A Russian minister said BP's experience in cleaning up the Gulf of Mexico oil spill was one of the reasons Russia chose the British oil firm. Imagine that. BP's British, according to the Russians. Huh. To help develop its fragile Arctic oil fields. BP and Russia's state-controlled oil company agreed this week to a multi-billion dollar deal under which they'll jointly explore for offshore oil in a deal that gives BP access to areas of the Arctic previously reserved for Russian firms. They've gained a great deal of experience in the Gulf of Mexico cleanup operation, said the chairman of the Russian firm, when asked why BP was chosen. BP, he said, has learned from this experience. BP's new chief, Bob Dudley, compare this with some statements Bob Dudley has made in the recent past, ladies and gentlemen, about BP and its role. Quote, now, in Russia, he says, to be honest, we've learned a lot about what happened in the Gulf of Mexico. It has shaken the company to the core. We are going to have renewed focus on safety and risk management. Unquote. Bob Dudley. Congratulations, BP. And now,
from CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is What Up, Dog? What Up, Dog? CPR's new news blogazine for the young and the newsless. Thanks for multitasking us into your day. I'm Cody Outscoop. Plenty of excitement around the What Up, Dog? Crib this week, with the announcement of a new astrological sign, Ophiuchus, the serpent handler. The announcement raised the question of whether the change in the Earth's axis might result in more astrological signs being added to the zodiac. Our guest today has a data dump for us on that subject, Dr. Susan Gosling of the Gosling Astrological Institute at the University of Reno. Dr. Gosling, welcome to the crib.
Thanks. This is cool.
Well, it's as cool as foundation funding will allow. So what are the signs that there may be new signs, and should we be worried?
Well, as to your second question, It depends, of course. Geminis should always be worried. It's in their nature.
But the time of year represented by Gemini has shifted this week for Sizzle.
Yes, and that's why we think there may be new astrological signs in the offing, or off the inning. The precession...
No, that's the shift in the Earth's axis. True that?
Right. It's a naturally occurring wobble, and it may not be through yet, so we're already locking in new signs just in case.
That's whack. You're actually inventing new signs of the zodiac?
Well, we're not inventing them. Many of them date from pre-Babylonian times, but we are copywriting them and trademarking the pictorial representations of them to prevent improper use of them.
Now, what would be an improper use, yeah?
Oh, anything that implied a commercial endorsement by Nefarious, for example.
That's one of the new signs?
Mm-hmm. Nefarious is the monkey child.
Oh, I saw his pictorial representation, as you call it. He's cool. I could friend him.
We've also got Gymnopédes, the balance beam performer, and Centaurus, the half-man, half-horse.
And these all correspond to celestial constellations or something?
Yes, although, as we've pointed out in our astrological fact check this week, reputable American astrologers base their readings on the positions and movements of the planets, not the stars anyway. Mm-hmm. We do have a program to certify astrologers, by the way, as part of our MAA degree.
Oh, and that is?
Master in Astrological Administration. Mm. We're the only for-profit university to offer that degree to working astrologers on a schedule that allows them to do their normal readings and still have time for all the coursework.
Dr. Gosling, maybe the million-dollar question, when will we know whether these new signs are in the mix?
Well, if I knew that, Cody, I'd be a psychic.
Word. Dr. Susan Gosling, thanks for chilling with us.
I wasn't actually that relaxed, but thank you.
Tomorrow's just a few mouse clicks away, and that's when we're back with another posting of What Up, Dog? Our thanks to the whole CPR News posse and to the Youthquake Foundation, keeping it real. I'm Cody Outscoop. Peace out. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Tell you, baby.
fast, it's clean, it's cheap, it's safe, it's too cheap to meter, it's not fast. It's nuclear power, our friend the atom. Dateline Montpelier, Vermont, a high-ranking engineer for the company that owns Vermont Yankee Nuclear Plant, we've talked about on this broadcast many is the time, said this week that leaks of radioactive water from two pipes didn't prompt plant personnel to inspect other pipes at the reactor to see whether they might show similar problems. Well, why should they? They're pipes. Entergy engineer Timothy Trask made the comments as the State Public Service Board began a four-day hearing on Vermont Yankee. Trask said the leaking pipes were merely a contributing cause of the tritium leak into test wells. He said they were not the most important or root cause of radioactive water reaching the environment. That was a gap in the wall of the concrete underground enclosure where the pipes were located. What root cause analysis was done with regard to the creation of the hole in the pipe, he was asked. None. It was a contributing cause. It was only such a root cause analysis that would have prompted an extent of condition review, that is to say, a check of the rest of the plant to determine how widespread a problem found in one area might be, like other pipes. Trask said the pipes that leaked had not been inspected for at least 10 years before they were found to have leaked. An improved inspection program had been put in place since the leaks were discovered, but he did not provide a definitive answer whether, under the revamped program, the pipes would have been inspected. He did say one of the methods by which any future leak would be detected would be when any elevated levels of tritium or other radioactive substances turned up in wells. Thank you. And operators of nuclear reactors will be allowed to store spent fuel rods and other radioactive waste on site for 60 more years beyond the operating life of the facility. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is reasonably assured that significant geologic repository capacity will be available when necessary to absorb the waste. They make this finding despite the Obama administration's decision to shut down the only such repository, Yucca Mountain. The finding was essential because it has been NRC policy since 1977 that it won't continue to license reactors if it didn't have reasonable confidence that the waste can and will be disposed of safely. So, it has to have that confidence if it wants to license nuclear plants. Faith-based or science? You tell me, ladies and gentlemen. And now...
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
NASA's inspector general has urged Congress to act immediately to prevent the waste of more than $500 million on a rocket program the country no longer wants. That program is Constellation, developed in part in Huntsville, Alabama. The lawmaker partly responsible for the potential waste, according to the inspector general, is U.S. Senator Richard Shelby, Republican of Tuscaloosa. The letter from the inspector general quotes Shelby legislation, but does not name Shelby, I guess because the IG wants to keep his job. Shelby spent much of last year at odds with NASA headquarters and the White House after headquarters supported the White House plan to kill Constellation. Congress and the White House agreed last year to replace Constellation with a new rocket and a new crew capsule. But Congress required the new program include as much of Constellation as possible in order not to waste the billions already spent. Shelby and other lawmakers acted to protect Constellation when the White House was trying to kill it. Shelby had an amendment passed that prohibited NASA from canceling Constellation in fiscal year 2010 after NASA froze nearly $1 billion in Constellation funding. Inspector General Paul Martin says the end result is NASA spending $200 million a month on Constellation and $575 million more on work it might have canceled. And the government's decision to bail out Citigroup at the height of the financial crisis was driven largely by gut instinct and fear, increasing the expectation that the government would step in to save troubled big firms in the future. That's according to Neil Barofsky, the special inspector general for the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Furthermore, he says, Treasury Secretary Geithner can't guarantee that extreme steps like winding down financial institutions won't be needed again in the future. News from the inspector general, ladies and gentlemen. copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Gut instinct, that's good. You don't need, you know, you really don't need, you know, objective information when you got gut instinct working for you. It's what works for so many of our presidents. And speaking of politics, you may have missed this as well this week. Former House Whip, House Majority Leader, House everything, when the Republicans ran the House, Tom DeLay, this week was sentenced to 3 years in jail for his role in a scheme by which he funneled corporate contributions to Republican Texas political candidates. It appears in Texas, ladies and gentlemen, although you can carry a gun to a bris, you cannot make a corporate contribution to any politician. So, according to this indictment of which, on which he was convicted, former Representative DeLay sent the funds to Washington, got him cleaned up, got him sent back to Texas. As I say, a 3-year jail sentence was imposed this week. He's free on bail, still defiant, but soon he may be singing a different tune.
Sugarland, Texas, sweet little place. No ordinary guy, ordinary face. Nice little business, killing bugs all day. Hit him with the bomb, follow up with the spray. Call me the exterminator, little play on words. After 20 years, killing bugs was for the birds. Ran for Congress, took the Sugarland Express to Washington, D.C. Clean up the mess. Speaker needs a gavel, fact of great renown. But when you want to do some business, gotta bring the hammer down. Gingrich Revolution, end of 94. Boehner and Dick Armey running the House floor. New was kind of snooty, all smarter than thou. Lost control of his member, my time was now. Had a little program, keep us in control. If you were a Democrat, you had no role. You want to lobby, had to hire our guys. To get along, don't go along, just get wise. Speaker had a gavel, they rode him out of town. But they knew I meant business when I'd bring the hammer down. Yeah, they called me the hammer for my domineering ways. Politics ain't beanbag, everybody pays. But enemies have memories about the folks in power. Friends just start forgetting. Sugarland got sour. Yeah, I funneled funds to maintain our rule. A liberal judge told me heels had to cool. Now I'm in the slammer, writing this song on the wall. Ever in Sugarland, be sure to call. Speaker's got the gavel, so does judge in his gown. Only the bugs were cheering the day they brought the hammer down.
And now news of the godly. Deadline Bucharest. Thousands of Orthodox Romanians lined up this week to fill bottles with holy water provided by churches for Epiphany. But in Timișoara, the supposedly miraculous liquid was supplied directly at the tap. Orthodox priest Zaharia Perez consecrated the water in the huge reservoirs supplying the city of 300,000. to allow as many believers as possible to benefit from its powers. The celebration of the Orthodox equivalent of Epiphany will bring peace to all those drinking this holy water, he said during Mass, while sprinkling holy water on the tanks and pipes of the water treatment plant. The initiative, which enjoyed the support of the water company, Aquitim, was hailed by many inhabitants. "It's great to have holy water at the tap," said one. "I've filled several bottles so I can drink a glass every now and then," she added. Other inhabitants chose to go to church to get the holy liquid, fearing the rusty pipes could deprive it of its powers. As fresh revelations of child sex abuse continue to emerge in Belgium's Catholic Church, an official church report shows most priests implicated were not prosecuted. The report handed by the church to the parliamentary inquiry and released this week details 134 cases of alleged abuse by priests over several decades. Of the 134, 90 of the priests remain alive. A further 50-odd complaints not yet on the list have been lodged since a church-backed commission last September revealed nearly 500 cases of abuse by priests and church workers since the 1950s, including 13 victims who committed suicide. Globally, less than one abuser out of six was inflicted the maximum penalty available to the bishop, definitive suspension. Even fewer, 16%, were effectively condemned by the judiciary. The situation differed from one part of the country to another. A largely Catholic country, Belgium, this is, still reeling from the revelations last year, with fresh allegations of abuse in institutions run by nuns. And this is all shaking the faith of followers in Belgium, with more and more people asking to be struck off baptism registers, a global movement known as de-baptism. News of the Godly, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this one right here, this very broadcast. News of the warm. Last year has tied 2005 as the warmest year on record. It's now official from NOAA and NASA this week. The decade that just ended included 9 of the 10 hottest years on record. My feet are feeling better. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, 7.415 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it on your computer or your tablet, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available for your smartphone through stitcher.com, and available as a free podcast from kcrw.com. And it'd be just like the Golden Globe Awards not being fixed, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Not fixed, just bought. Alrighty, thank you very much. tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in Exile, and Hawaii desks. I think Chicago's back in Chicago. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast and the list of music played here on available at harryshearer.com. Le Show is on Twitter at The Harry Shearer, now serving more than 22,000 followers. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.